Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for April 20th, 2007. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science Magazine. In today's show, we'll see how slowdowns in NIH budget growth are putting biomedical researchers in a bind. We'll also look at some new findings on how temperature determines the sex of offspring in certain reptile species, and at the potentially far-reaching effects of the recent rise in aquaculture. All this plus our usual roundup of other stories from Science and its online daily news site, Science Now. So stick around. At the top of the show today, crunch time at the NIH. The U.S. National Institutes of Health is one of the richest research funding agencies on the planet, at least on paper. But as Science news writers Jennifer Cousin and Greg Miller investigate in a News Focus article this week, the growth of NIH's bankroll has shrunk significantly in the past few years. And that's putting life scientists across the U.S. in a real bind. Jennifer is in the studio to tell us more. Jennifer, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, Jennifer, only a few years ago, I guess budget crunch was hardly a phrase I would have associated with the NIH. As I recall, the NIH budget actually doubled between 1998 and 2003. What's happened since then to change that?
Well, you're right. Between 98 and 2003, the NIH budget went from just under $14 billion to just over $27 billion. But after that doubling ended, the growth rate in NIH's budget slowed substantially. And we're now going into the fourth year, 2007, in which the NIH budget is growing at a rate below biomedical inflation. So many scientists feel that the budget in real terms is actually shrinking.
Even with that slowdown in growth, the NIH budget now in 2007 is at $29.2 billion. That still sounds like quite a war chest.
It absolutely is quite a war chest, and this is something that Greg and I thought a lot about in the course of working on this story. I think what we found that we were seeing here is really a shift in the growth rate, and that was what was important, maybe even more than the actual numbers. NIH gets money on an annual basis, and it has to spend most of the money it gets each year. So when the budget was really exploding in the late 90s and early 2000s, there was a big boom at universities and medical schools, lots of new buildings, expansion, the hiring of many new faculty, and that actually lagged a little bit behind the actual budget increases since it takes time to build. So now what we're seeing is actually some expansion that's still going on, but the money that's available is shrinking, even as there are thousands more applicants to NIH than there were a few years ago.
So it's kind of a classic bubble scenario. We have the doubling of the NIH budget, and that stoked a boost in demand for biomedical funding, and now NIH can't keep up with that growth.
Yeah, I think that's true. And NIH tells us that, for example, in 98, there were fewer than 20,000 scientists who tried to get research grants from the agency. And this year, that's expected to now be over 35,000 people. Meanwhile, costs of equipment, salaries, other costs are going up, and that's really putting a strain on the system and is worrying a lot of people.
What about the role of kind of what's called big science in all of this? Is that sort of draining off a lot of resources?
Well, that's a good question. A lot of the scientists that we spoke with outside of NIH did feel that that was an issue. And it's true that after the success of the Human Genome Project, NIH has launched some big initiatives, some big team initiatives that reach across universities. And NIH certainly stands behind them as being necessary. The numbers do show a little bit of a shift towards that, but not a big shift. But I think what's happened, too, is that the competition for individual grants, the smaller, quote-unquote smaller science, is where things have really intensified. And so there is more of a crunch there than maybe in the bigger projects.
Yeah, I think one of the more interesting and sobering aspects of your article was the impact that this is having on individual scientists in the real world. Could you give a couple of examples of that?
Yeah, absolutely. We spoke with a number of people at all different stages of their careers who are really feeling this. One researcher I spoke with had spent his career at Mass General Hospital in Boston, about 20 years there, and his research took a sort of an interesting new turn, and he then started having trouble getting grant money, and he just next month is leaving to go to an institute that does not rely as much on NIH money, a smaller institute outside of Boston. We also spoke with younger scientists who were both affected in that they were having some trouble getting grant money and were really worrying about the future. Another young man who had done a postdoctoral fellowship at MIT just left research altogether because he just felt like he was seeing his mentors expressing lots of anxiety about the funding situation, even though he didn't need money himself right then in that way. He was just really concerned about the future.
And all of this, I guess, also puts the people reviewing these grant proposals in a bit of a bind as well. I mean, there's got to be a lot more good projects than there is money to fund them.
Yeah, I think that's true. And certainly what we've seen is that the percentage of research proposals funded by NIH has gone from about 32% in 2000, 2001, down to 21% this year. And some people say that the peer review system, which relies on outside scientists to review grant applications, isn't really designed to ferret out the very, very, very top applications in quite that way. It often has trouble distinguishing between the really good applications and those that are also quite good, but maybe just a little bit less good than that. Another problem that we've seen is that as both the number of applications has gone up and the pressure on scientists to apply for lots of grants themselves has increased, NIH is also just having a harder time finding peer reviewers to put on its committees.
Well, Jennifer, what does the future hold on all of this?
I think that's something that everyone would really like to know, and right now we don't. There is hope, or some hope, among scientists that the budget may stabilize next year, and Congress is going to be considering later this year what to do about that. It's not really clear long-term what the effect of these several years of flat budget will be. Some people worry that we're really going to lose a lot of younger scientists. Others say that really hasn't happened yet, and in the long run, it may not have a big effect, but it's certainly something we're going to be watching.
Well, Jennifer, thanks for dropping in to tell us about this.
Thanks for having me.
Science news writers Jennifer Cousin and Greg Miller report on the impacts of the NIH budget crunch in the April 20th issue of Science. You can find the article on our website at science.sciencemag.org. Just around the corner, a torrid tale of reptilian sex selection. Stay with us.
Did you know that AAAS members help plug the power of science into public policy? Since 1973, we've brought nearly 2,000 scientists and engineers to Washington, D.C. as science and technology policy fellows. They provide scientific analysis to policymakers in congressional offices and in federal agencies. Find out more at fellowships.AAAS.org. AAAS. Advancing science careers, enhancing public policy.
It's long been known that in some reptile species, the sex of offspring is determined not by sex chromosomes, as in mammals, but by the temperature of the eggs during embryonic development. But could both mechanisms operate in the same species? New work reported in the April 20th Science suggests that the answer is a surprising yes. Alexander Quinn, the lead author of the study, is on the line with us now to talk about it. Mr. Quinn, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Stuart. It's great to be here.
First, Mr. Quinn, some background. As I mentioned in the introduction, reptiles, it seems, have two different mechanisms of sex determination. Could you take us through those?
Yes, that's right. Sex determination in reptiles has traditionally been sort of separated into two main categories. And these are genotypic sex determination and temperature-dependent sex determination. In the first of these, genotypic sex determination, it's known as GSD for short, there are basically genes which instruct the embryo to develop as either a male or a female. And these genes are carried on the chromosomes, designated as the sex chromosomes. And there's actually two main types of sex chromosome systems found amongst plants and animals. In the first sort of type of system, males actually have two different sex chromosomes, and these are called the X chromosome and the Y chromosome, whereas the females have a pair of identical X chromosomes. And this, of course, is a system seen in humans and actually almost all mammals as well. Many species, though, have a reverse system of sex chromosomes where it's actually the female which has two different sex chromosomes. We call these the Z and the W. and the male has a pair of identical Z chromosomes. All birds and actually all snakes also have this, the system of ZW females and ZZ males. And as you mentioned, the other major mechanism found in reptiles is temperature-dependent sex determination, or TSD. In TSD, it's not the genes on the sex chromosomes that decide if an embryo will develop as male or female, but it's the temperature during a critical period of embryonic development. Since most reptiles lay eggs, of course, the eggs are subject to the incubation temperature of the nest. And for instance, many turtles show a common pattern of TSD in which cooler nests produce all male hatchlings, but warmer nests produce all females. So basically, reptiles are a great group for studying sex determination because they show an amazing diversity of sex-determining mechanisms.
Okay, so there's a lot going on in reptiles for determining sex, and if I'm understanding this correctly, it's generally been believed in the past that a reptile species had either the genotypic mode or the other. That is, you either had sex chromosomes or the temperature-dependent system, but not both.
Yeah, that's right. For a long time, it was thought to be the case that sex chromosomes were incompatible with temperature-determined sex, both for theoretical reasons, but more importantly because no reptiles had really been demonstrated to have both mechanisms influencing their sex development. However, if you look closely at the evolutionary relationships between reptiles, it's quite clear that in groups like turtles and lizards, there must have been many evolutionary switches between GSD and TSD modes, and probably in both directions. There's even species within the same family or genus which have the alternate mechanisms. So in an earlier paper, our research team suggested that there are likely to be reptile species which are in a transitional state between genetic and temperature-determined sex.
And so to get at testing that prediction, you studied this particular species, the Australian central bearded dragon lizard, I think it's called. What made you focus on that lizard in particular?
Well, our initial idea was to look at sex determination in a range of agamid dragons. And this is a group which has both TSD and GSD species. In some cases, even within the same genus. So it really is an ideal group to study the evolution of sex-determining mechanisms. And we settled on the central bearded dragon as our model species for a number of reasons, really. It's very common in parts of Australia, which made it relatively easy to find pregnant females. It's a large species as dragons go, so females actually produce large numbers of eggs in a clutch, which helps in the analysis of hatchling sex ratios. And we knew from previous studies by other researchers that bearded dragons have genetic determined sex because incubation experiments across a range of temperatures usually showed even sex ratios, and that indicates that they have sex chromosomes. So in another previous paper, we used some fairly advanced cytogenetic techniques to determine if a bearded dragon has ZW or XY sex chromosomes. And it turned out that it has ZW sex chromosomes, just like birds do. And for the current study, we were looking for evidence of temperature influences on offspring sex in the bearded dragon. So what we did was we took a large number of bearded dragon eggs and incubated them in a lab across a very wide range of temperatures, much wider than had been attempted before. We wanted to find out if there were temperatures which dominate sex determination and override the sex chromosomes. But to be able to do this, we actually needed a method of identifying the genetic sex of hatchlings. And chromosomal techniques, they're really too laborious for sexing large number of individuals. So what we did was we used a PCR-based molecular technique called AFLP to develop a DNA marker, which enabled us to identify if the hatchlings are genotypically male or female.
So essentially you had a method whereby you could quickly determine the genotypic signature of sex in these animals, and then presumably by examining them you could determine the phenotypic sex of them. So what did you find in these experiments?
Well, what we found was very clear evidence for a strong influence of high temperature on sex determination in this reptile, and that was happening in spite of their sex chromosomes. So at most incubation temperatures, there was an even number of male and female offspring, as you'd expect in a species with sex chromosomes. But at high temperatures, there was a sudden and dramatic rise in the number of females produced, right up to 100% females at the highest temperatures. I should make it clear at this point that I'm referring to the phenotypic sex of these hatchlings. Essentially means whether they develop physically as males or females. And we were able to determine this, as you asked, by looking at their gonads, if they had ovaries or testes. And so we then applied this DNA sex marker that we developed to determine the genotypic sex of these hatchlings. So they could tell us if they were ZZ or ZW chromosome animals. And this very clearly demonstrated that at high temperatures, around half of these phenotypic female hatchlings were actually genotypically male. So basically, in other words, they were genetic males with ZZ chromosomes, but they were sex-reversed to become phenotypic females. by contrast, at the lower temperatures, there was almost no sex reversal of the hatchlings. So what we really achieved here was the first conclusive demonstration that temperature can determine sex in a reptile with sex chromosomes. And what's especially interesting is that the pattern of 100% females at high temperatures in the bearded dragon is also what you see in other dragon species with a classical pattern of temperature-dependent sex determination, where it's been expected that sex chromosomes won't be present. So our study has opened up the unexpected possibility, I guess, that sex chromosomes might exist in many TSD reptiles.
So sex chromosomes might exist in many reptiles that have the temperature-dependent mode as well.
That's right.
Well, that's a very interesting and exciting result, given that you've seen now this temperature-dependent mode in a place that you wouldn't have expected to find it. Could you give us an idea of how you view sort of the larger significance of this work and what this tells us about the evolution of these mechanisms that we didn't know before?
Well, since we've demonstrated here that TSD and GSD mechanisms can actually coexist in the one species, it does imply there could be a whole range of reptiles with varying degrees of temperature and gene interaction determining their sex. So we think the difference between GSD and TSD species is probably quantitative rather than qualitative, and that's quite a change to what has been thought before. Very little is actually known about why some reptiles have temperature-dependent sex and others genetically determined sex. We've hypothesized in our paper that there's probably a relatively simple evolutionary pathway between TSD and GSD forms. The high temperature effect on sex that we see in the bearded dragon, it might really provide the raw material for natural selection to act upon and gradually switch a species like this one to a more classical TSD system. As a final point, it's kind of been recognised for some time that reptiles with temperature-determining sex could be particularly vulnerable to climate change, since heavily skewed sex ratios might cause populations to crash to extinction. And our study implies that perhaps many GSD species might be of concern as well, because high temperatures might actually produce 100% of one sex in many other species, like the bearded dragon.
Well, Mr. Quinn, thanks very much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Alexander Quinn at the University of Canberra in Australia is the lead author, with five colleagues from the University of Canberra and the Australian National University, of a new study on the coexistence of temperature and genotypic sex determination in reptiles. The study appears in the April 20th edition of Science. Coming up in a moment, aquaculture on the rise.
Did you know that the journal Science was founded by Thomas Edison in 1880? Even Edison's inventive mind could not have imagined its evolution into the world's leading journal of groundbreaking research and scientific news, in print and online. AAAS members can access seminars, podcasts, and all issues since 1880. Read today's stories and preview tomorrow's research, all at www.sciencemag.org. AAAS, advancing science into the future.
While most of us have more than a passing familiarity with the domestication of land plants and animals, everything from maize and snow peas to cows and dogs, the domestication of marine species is far less known among us landlubbers. Yet, as Carlos Duarte and two colleagues discuss in a perspective article in this week's Science, the 20th and 21st centuries have seen a stunning increase in the number and variety of aquatic species under human cultivation. And, they argue, the trend is likely to bring profound changes in our relationship with the marine realm. We have Dr. Duarte on the line to tell us more about this sea change. Dr. Duarte, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Duarte, before we actually wade into the oceans, let's spend a moment on dry land. One of the points your paper brings out is that in terms of the actual species that have been brought under cultivation, land agriculture really hasn't changed that much over the past 2,000 years. Could you give us some background on that?
Yes. Domestication of land plants and animals started about 10,000 years ago. And the vast majority of the species that have been cultivated, both animals and plants, were already domesticated by about 2,000 years ago. And provided these figures, we could argue that modern agriculture is still Neolithic in terms of the species that are being used.
So agriculture looks very Neolithic on land, but I guess that contrasts with aquaculture. If I'm understanding your article correctly, the growth in aquaculture is largely something that's happened over the past century or so. Why did it take so much longer for aquaculture to gain traction than for agriculture to?
Yeah, your understanding is correct. And the rise of aquaculture is a contemporary phenomenon, with about 10 times as many aquatic animals brought into culture relative to the number of land animals that are being cultivated. And most of that, of this development has happened within the last 30 years. And the reason for this 2000 time lag between domestication of land and aquatic species is very complex. There are many reasons why this has happened, but I would like to highlight two of the reasons that we offer in our paper. First, and probably most important, is that fisheries, which is the equivalent of hunting on land, has been able to deliver sufficient food and also to meet growing demands for seafood from a growing human populations until just recently, where a ceiling to the production of fisheries apparently has been met. And this has happened within the last, say, decade to two decades. And this has been a major force in the development of aquaculture, because fisheries alone wasn't able to produce the food demands of the population. And in addition to this, the domestication of aquatic species requires probably far more knowledge in terms of the biology of the species than domestication of land species, which are mostly mammals, does. And this knowledge has only become available again with the rise of biology in the last 2 to 3 decades.
So commercial fishing wasn't outstripped in terms of food demand as quickly as hunting was, I guess, on land, is what you're saying.
Yeah, precisely.
And also there's a certain amount of sort of additional complexity in aquaculture that maybe isn't there in agriculture. So let's look at the scope of this change. I mean, you said this, a lot of this has actually happened over the past 30 years, not the past century, as I had suggested. So how fast is aquaculture growing now, and what sort of species are being brought under cultivation now?
Well, the rate of increase in the domestication of marine species is quite phenomenal, and the rate of increase is about 3% per year, and this rate is 100-fold faster than the rate of domestication of land species ever was. And about 10 new species are brought into culture every year, and those include fish, crustaceans, mollusks, worms, and jellyfish, quite unlikely candidates for human food, but they're being grown already for human food. And only in the last decade, there has been over 100 species that have been brought into culture. And there is, I would argue, and we argue so in the paper, a very large scope for further growth in terms of the number of species domesticated. And this is so because there's an additional 3,000 wild marine species that are being harvested for food and could possibly be brought into culture. And as this happens, that is, as we bring more and more species into culture, the production of aquaculture is growing by 8% per year, which is 4 times faster than the rate of food production on land.
Well, that's really extraordinary. I guess in thinking about the marine system as a whole, you could sort of argue that there are pluses and minuses in this trend. How do you see that, the pluses and minuses?
Yes, you are correct. Most of the focus on aquaculture in the past has been on the possible negative consequences of aquaculture as presently practiced. And in fact, aquaculture can have detrimental effects on the marine environment, and these are due to the excess inputs of substances and chemicals that are used in the feed or to protect the organisms, and also the use of wild stocks as food. However, I would argue that these impacts are of a far lesser scale than the impacts that agriculture has had and still has. The challenge is to develop a sustainable model for aquaculture, and there are many, many scientists that are working towards delivering this model under new, exciting developments that suggest that a sustainable aquaculture is really within our reach. And on the other hand, there are also positive consequences of aquaculture, and particularly aquaculture has environmental benefits because it can release pressure on wild stocks of animals, many of which are already overexploited and some are endangered. And in the future, perhaps aquaculture could become a positive force in conserving marine biodiversity.
Well, let's kind of close up here by looking just on an even larger scale, if we could. I mean, I got the impression from your article that you view what's happening here as something of a revolution, and I was wondering what your thoughts were on on an even more sort of global scale of what the impacts of this trend are going to be.
Yeah, we believe that this change is of such a magnitude that it will be, in hindsight, considered one of the major milestones in human history and civilization. The problem is that this is much too contemporary for us to realize, and perhaps in a way we could say that the trees are hiding the forest. And probably marine aquaculture will relegate fisheries to a comparable role as hunting has on land. And the rise of aquaculture may modify the patterns of consumption of food by societies. It can modify human diet, employment, and also the livelihoods of those involved, because there are already offshore farms that require that employees and their families live offshore at sea. And they're actually in Asia, floating cities with churches and stores where people live in a floating city where food is being grown. And more consequentially, I believe that aquaculture will likely become fundamental in the future in releasing the pressure on freshwater resources that will be likely the bottleneck to feed the 9,000 million population of humans on Earth in the future, because marine aquaculture is essentially free in terms of freshwater consumption.
Well, Dr. Duarte, that's quite a story. Thanks very much for being with us today to clue us in on this.
Thank you for your interest.
Carlos Duarte with the Spanish Council for Scientific Research is the author with two colleagues of Rapid Domestication of Marine Species, a perspective article appearing in this week's Science. Finally today, Eric Stockstead, the managing editor of Science's free daily news site, Science Now, is in the studio with Tanisha Riley of AAAS for our usual roundup of other recent stories.
Eric, welcome back. What have you got for us today?
Three stories today. We're going to talk about the genetic differences between chimps and humans, about Newton's second law of motion and whether it still holds true, and finally, a story about the sex lives of mites.
Those all sound very interesting. Okay, let's start with the chimps.
Well, think about the physical differences between chimps and humans. There are a lot of them. And so you might think that humans have really evolved a lot since humans and chimps parted evolutionary ways. Well, a group was interested in finding out if there really was a burst of evolution in humans. And what they did was they combed through 14,000 genes looking for genes that evolved quickly. And when they tabulated it up, they found 154 human genes that had positive selection. And that means that these genes had changed in a way that conferred a benefit on the animal. And they found, in contrast, they found 233 chimp genes with positive selection. So that means in the last 7 million years, chimps have actually had more genes changed than humans have.
So why would chimpanzees have evolved faster than humans?
One idea is that chimps had larger populations. And so population genetics theory suggests that a larger population will have more adaptive traits evolve. But there's a key thing to remember, and that is that we're just looking at one kind of genetic change here, and that's amino acid substitutions. And there are a lot of other things that go on in the genome, so we really don't have the full picture yet to be able to say that chimps really did evolve a whole lot more than humans did.
And the next story about someone verifying Newton's second law again. Now, I thought we took care of this before.
Well, this is probably the second of the top two equations that most people remember from physics, and this one is F equals ma, force equals mass times acceleration, and it's pretty intuitive. But the question is, does it hold true in really extreme situations? And one of those extreme situations is way out on the fringes of galaxies where stars appear to be moving much faster than you would expect. They ought to be flung out away from the galaxies. And an idea is that that might be the case because Newton's second law of motion doesn't hold true at a really for really small accelerations.
So what did they do to test this?
Well, they got out a plumb bob. Well, not exactly a plumb bob. They got out a little cylindrical weight, and they put it on an extremely thin wire and spun it back and forth. So that's a kind of torsional pendulum. It doesn't swing back and forth. Mm-hmm. It rotates back, forwards and backwards. And then they checked out the amount that it accelerated. And they found that for even infinitesimally small for us accelerations, Newton's law still held. That's 0.00005 nanometers per second squared.
All right. So now we know that Newton's law really works. So what does this mean for us now?
Feels good, huh?
Oh, yeah. It feels great. I've been waiting my whole life for this one.
Well, to zoom out to the galactic perspective, it suggests that, as most cosmologists think, that the reason these stars are not flinging themselves out of the galactic realm is because they are held there by gravitational attraction to what's called dark matter.
Okay. We had a dark matter piece in the past. Okay, this is all coming back to me. And finally, Eric, a sexual revolution in soil mites. Wow, this got to be good. You got to explain this one.
Well, I think of it more as sort of a tender coming of age story, really.
So no Woodstock for the soil mites?
This gets to the nature of sex, which is, as we all know, very complex. But if you think about mites, 10% of mites reproduce asexually, and that's through a process called parthenogenesis. That means that females lay eggs, and the eggs aren't fertilized. They develop into more females and no males. But every so often, males are born, but they're sterile, and that suggests that these mites haven't lost the genes for sexual reproduction. The question then is, have they lost it entirely? And the way a group tried to figure this out was by setting up or figuring out a family tree of a lot of different mite species. And what they found was that some of these mites had long ago sexually reproduced, and then lost that ability. They started to go through parthenogenesis. And one of those species, this is where it gets interesting, one of those species has now gone back to sexual reproduction.
Okay, so these mites have re-evolved sexual reproduction, is what you're saying. And why would they do such a thing?
If you have to ask, Tunisia. The idea is that sex allows new adaptive traits to arise. Now, most of the ancestors and relatives of these mites that got their sex back live in soil. And the mites that we're talking about moved into trees, which is perhaps a more stressful environment. So going back to sex may help them cope better.
Well, Eric, thanks for stopping by. Eric Stockstedt is the managing editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with these and other stories on the site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
And that wraps up the April 20th, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the show. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science. On behalf of the journal and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.